Why aren't you laughing? From the outside, our house on the North Carolina coast, the C-section, is nothing much to look at. It might have been designed by a 10-year-old with a ruler. That's how basic it is. Walls, roof, windows, deck. It's easy to imagine the architect putting down his crayon and shouting into the next room, "I'm done! Can I watch TV now?" Whenever I denigrate the place, he reminds me that it's the view that counts, the ocean we look out at. I see his point, but it's not like you have to limit yourself to one or the other. What about West Sussex, I say. From the outside, our cottage in England resembles something you'd find in a storybook, a home for pot-bellied trolls, benevolent ones that smoke pipes. Built of stone in the late 16th century, it has a pitched roof and little windows with panes the size of playing cards. We lie in bed and consider sheep grazing in the shadow of a verdant down. I especially love being there in winter, so it bothered me when I had to spend most of January and February working in the United States. Hugh came along, and toward the end we found ourselves on Maui, where I had a reading. I'd have been happy just to fly in and fly out, but Hugh likes to swim in the ocean, so we stayed for a week in a place he found online. Let me guess, the box office manager of the theater I performed at said. It spread out over at least 4 levels and paneled in dark wood like something you'd see on a 1970s TV show, right? He'd hit it squarely on the nose, especially the dark part. The wood on the interior walls had been rigorously stained and was almost the color of fudge, a stark contrast to the world outside, which was relentlessly, almost oppressively bright. As for the various levels, any excuse seemed to have been taken to add stairs, even if only 2 or 3. If you lived there full time, you'd no doubt get the hang of them. As it was, I tripped or fell down at least 2x a day. The house reminded me of the condominium units my family used to rent on Emerald Isle when I was in my 20s, though none of those had a crucifix hanging in the kitchen. This one was 10 inches tall and supported a slender, miserable Christ, plated in bronze. That was the only decoration, aside from a number of framed photo collages of the owner and his family taken over the years. They were a good-looking group, one that multiplied as the children grew and had kids of their own. The color in the earlier snapshots had faded, just as it has in pictures of my own family. Same haircuts, same flared slacks and shirts with long droopy collars, only now drained of their vibrancy, like lawns in winter. Each generation looked healthy and prosperous, yet I found myself wondering what lurked beneath the surface, for surely there was something. "Which of you is in prison now?" I'd ask, glancing up as I tripped on the stairs to the bedroom. The house was on the ocean, and the beach that began where the backyard ended was shaded with palms. Most often it was deserted, so except for a few short trips up the coast for supplies, Hugh stayed put during our week on Maui. If he wasn't on the deck overlooking the water, he was in the water, looking back at the deck. He saw whales and sea turtles. He snorkeled. My only accomplishment was to sign my name to 5,000 blank sheets of paper sent by my publisher, tip-ins, they're called. A month or 2 down the line, they'd be bound into copies of the book I had just about finished. There were still a few more weeks to make changes, but they could only be minor grammatical things. Hugh, who is good at spotting typos and used to do so for his father, a novelist, was reading the manuscript for the first time. Whenever I heard him laugh, I'd ask, "What's so funny?" Should 5 or 10 minutes pass with no reaction, I'd call out, "Why aren't you laughing?" It takes quite a while to sign your name 5,000 times, so I set myself a daily goal and would stop whatever I was doing every 2 hours and pick up my magic marker. Often, while autographing, I'd listen to the radio or watch a TV show I like called Intervention. In it, real-life alcoholics and drug addicts are seen going about their business. Most are too far gone to hold down jobs, so mainly we see them starting fights, crying on unmade beds, and shooting up in hard-to-spot places like the valleys between their toes. Amazing, to me, is that anyone would allow him or herself to be filmed in this condition. "Did you catch me on TV?" I'd imagine them saying to their friends. "Wasn't it incredible when I shit on that car?" That's what a 31-year-old drunk woman did in one of the episodes I watched as I signed blank sheets of paper, pulled down her pants, positioned herself just so, and defecated on the rear bumper of a parked Audi A4. As she went at it, a diamond shape blurring her from the waist down, I thought of my mother, in part because she was a lady. By this, I mean that she never wore pants, just skirts and dresses. She never left the house without makeup on and her hair styled. Whenever I see a young woman boarding a plane in her pajamas or a guy in a t-shirt that reads, "Your hole is my goal," I always wonder what Mom would think. She's been dead for almost 30 years, so she missed a lot of the buildup to what is now thought of as less than scandalous behavior. I once watched a show in which a group of young men were sent out to collect pubic hair. It was a contest of sorts, and in the end, the loser had to put all the spoils on a pizza and eat it. That was in 2003, so to me, someone on television shitting on a car, sure, okay, that makes sense. To go there straight from murder, she wrote, however, would be quite a shock. Another reason intervention makes me think about my mother is that she was an alcoholic. It's a hard word to use for someone you love, and so my family avoided it. Rather, we'd whisper among ourselves that Mom had a problem, that she could stand the cutback. Sober, she was cheerful and charismatic, the kind of person who could and would talk to anyone. Unlike our father, who makes jokes no one understands and leaves his listeners baffled and eager to get away, it was fun to hear what our mom might come out with. "I got them laughing," was a popular line in the stories she'd tell at the end of the day. The men who pumped her gas, the bank tellers, the receptionists at the dentist's office, "I got them laughing." Her specialty was the real-life story, perfected and condensed. These take work, and she'd go through a half dozen verbal drafts before getting one where she wanted it. Over the course of the day, the line she wished she'd delivered in response to some question or comment, the zinger, would become the line she had delivered. "So I said to him, 'Buddy, that's why they invented the airplane.'" We'd be on the sidelines aghast. "That's not how it happened at all." But what did it matter with such great results? You'd think my mother could have seen the difference between the sunny, likable her and the dark one who'd call late at night. I could hear the ice cubes in her glass rushing forth whenever she took a sip. In my youth, when she joined my father for a drink after work, "Just one, I have to get dinner on the table," that was a happy sound. Now it was like a trigger being cocked. "The little bitch," my mother would say, her voice slurred, referring to someone she might have spoken to that afternoon or maybe 5 years earlier, a shop clerk, a neighbor, "talking to me that way, like that, like I'm nothing. She doesn't know it, but I could buy and sell her." Fly home for a visit and you'd find her in the kitchen, slamming around, replaying some argument she'd had with our father. "Goddamn bastard, shove it up your ass, why don't you? You and your stinking, why hire a plumber when I can do it myself? You can't do it yourself, you hear me, buddy? You can't." Late in her life, my mother embraced the word fuck, but could never quite figure out its place in a sentence. "So I said to him, 'I don't give a damn fuck what you do with it. Just get it the hell out of my driveway.'" By that point in the evening, she'd look different, raw, like you'd taken the lady she was earlier and peeled her. The loafers she favored would have been kicked off, and she'd be in her stocking feet, hands on the counter to steady herself as she raged. She was hardly ever angry at the person she was talking to, exceptions being my brother Paul, my father, and my sister Tiffany. Rather, she'd be looking for support. "Can you believe this shit? I mean, can you?" We didn't dare contradict her. I have an English friend named Ingrid, and her father was an alcoholic. When he lost his license for driving drunk, he got himself a tricycle and would pedal it back and forth to a pub, everyone in the village watching. "Not a regular bike?" I asked. "He would have fallen off," Ingrid told me, relieved to be at the stage where she could laugh about it. Her father was a horrible person, a mean clown, which makes it easier, in a way. Our mother did nothing so cartoonish, and if she had, we'd have felt traitorous making fun of her. Instead, we separated her into two people, and discounted what the second drunk one did, for that wasn't really her, we reasoned, but a kind of virus talking. Her father had it, too, and drank until men in white coats carted him off to the state hospital where he received shock treatments. I look at pictures of him after his release and think, wait, that's me. We didn't resemble each other when I was young, but now we could be twins. The big moment on intervention is when family and friends of the alcoholic or drug addict confront him or her. It's supervised by a counselor and often takes place in a sad hotel conference room with flesh-colored furniture and no windows. The addicts are usually in full blossom, drunk or high or on the nod. What the hell? They say, looking around at their parents, their brothers and sisters, their wives or husbands, all together, seated in a semicircle. The subjects of the intervention already feel ambushed, so steps are taken to keep them from feeling attacked as well. It's easy to lose one's temper in this situation, so the counselor has instructed the friends and family members to organize their thoughts on paper. The letters they read are never wholly negative and usually kick off with a pleasant memory. I remember when you were brought home from the hospital is a big one. This is the equivalent of a short story beginning with the main character's alarm clock going off, and though I know I shouldn't get hung up on this part of the show, I do. Oh, please, I think, rolling my eyes as the combative meth addict is told, you had a smile that could light up a room. The authors of the letters often cry, perhaps because what they've written is so poorly constructed. Then again, reality TV is fueled by tears. Take another of the shows I like, My 600-Pound Life, about morbidly obese people struggling with their weight. At the start of each program, loved ones appear, always weeping, always saying the exact same thing. I don't want to have to bury my own child, / sister, / nephew, etc. Yes, well, I wouldn't either, I think. If digging the grave didn't do me in, I'd surely die trying to roll that massive body into it. There's crying on hoarders as well, though rarely by the pack rat, who sees no downside to saving all his used toilet paper. After everyone on intervention has had their say, the addicts are offered a spot in a rehab center. Not all of them accept, but most do. The places they're sent to tend to be sunny, Arizona, Southern California, Florida. We see them 2 months into their stay, most looking like completely different people. Here are the wind chimes I made in my arts and crafts group, the woman who earlier in the program was seen shooting speed into her neck says. Not everyone stays the prescribed 90 days. Some leave early and relapse. Others get out on schedule and relapse a week or 6 months later. The hardiest of them are revisited several years down the line, still sober, many with jobs now and children. All that time I wasted, they say. What on earth was I thinking? I asked Ingrid once if she ever talked to her father about his drinking, and I think she was ashamed to answer no. Not that I or anyone in my family ever confronted my mother, no matter how bad it got. Even my dad, who's super direct and tells complete strangers that they're loud or wrong or too fat for that bolero jacket, said nothing. Then again, it built so gradually. For as long as I was living at home, it never seemed a problem. It was only after 5 of her 6 children had left that she upped her quota. The single scotch before dinner became 2, and then 3. Her wine intake doubled, tripled. She was never a quality drinker. Quantity was what mattered. She bought jugs, not bottles. After dinner, she'd switch to coffee and then back to scotch or wine, supplementing the alcohol with pills. Mom's dolls, we called them. When she told us that she would no longer drive at night, that she couldn't see the road, we all went along with it, knowing the real reason was that by sunset she was in no shape to get behind the wheel. Gosh, we said, we hope that doesn't happen to our eyes when we're your age. In that respect, you have to hand it to the family members on intervention. Corny letters notwithstanding, they have guts. The person they're confronting might storm out of the room and never talk to them again, but at least they're rolling the dice. Though we never called our mother on her behavior, she knew that we noticed it. "I haven't had a drink in 4 days," she'd announce out of nowhere, usually over the phone. You could hear the struggle and the hope in her voice. I'd call her the next night and could tell right away that she'd lost her willpower. "Why aren't you stronger?" I wanted to ask. "I mean, really, can't you just try harder?" Of course, I was drunk too, so what could I say? I suppose I felt that my youth made it less sad. The vast plain of adulthood stretched before me while she was well into her 50s, drinking alone in a house filled with crap. Even sober, she'd rail against that, all the junk my father dragged home and left in the yard or the basement, old newspapers and magazines, toaster ovens picked out of the trash, hoses, sheets of plywood, all of it perfectly good, all of it just what he needed. In my mind, our house used to be so merry. There was music playing in every room, the phone was always ringing. People in my family laughed more than people in other families. I was as sure of that as I was of anything. Up and down the street, our neighbors left their dinner tables as soon as they could and beat it for the nearest TV. That's what my father did, while the rest of us stayed put with our mother, vying for her attention as the candles burned down. Group therapy, she called it, though it was more like a master class. One of us would tell a story about our day, and she'd interject every now and then to give notes. "You don't need all that detail about the bedroom," she'd say, or, "Maybe it's best to skip the part about the teacher and just cut to the chase." "Pour me a cup of coffee," she'd say, come 10 o'clock, our empty plate still in front of us. "Get me another pack of Winstons from the pantry, will you?" One of the perks of having 6 kids was that you didn't have to locate anything on your own. "Find my car keys," she'd command, or "someone get me a pair of shoes." There was never a rebellion because it was her asking. Pleasing our mother was fun and easy and made us feel good. "I'll light her cigarette." "No, I will." Maybe ours wasn't the house I'd have chosen had I been in charge of things. It wasn't as clean as I'd have liked. From the outside, it wasn't remarkable. We had no view. But still, it was the place I held in mind, and proudly, when I thought home. It had been a living organism, but by the time I hit my late 20s, it was rotting, a dead tooth in a row of seemingly healthy ones. When I was 11, my father planted a line of olive bushes in front of the house. They were waist high and formed a kind of fence. By the mid-80s, they were so overgrown that pedestrians had to quit the sidewalk and take to the street instead. People with trash to drop waited until they reached our yard to drop it, figuring the high grass would cover whatever beer can or plastic bag of dog shit they needed to discard. It was like the Addams Family house, which would have been fine had it still been Mary, but it wasn't anymore. Our mother became the living ghost that haunted it. Gaunt now and rattling ice cubes instead of chains. I'd come home from Chicago where I was living, and she would offer to throw a dinner party for my friends. "Invite the Sieglers," she'd say, and, "Hey, Dean or Lynn, I haven't seen her in a while." She was lonely for company, so I'd pick up the phone. By the time my guests arrived, she'd be wasted. My friends all noticed it. How could they not? Sitting at the table as she repeated a story for the third time, I got them laughing. Watching as she stumbled, as the ash of her cigarette fell onto the floor, I'd cringe and then feel guilty for being embarrassed by her. Had I not once worn a top hat to meet her at the airport, a top hat and suspenders, with red platform shoes? I was 17 that year, but still, and how many times had I been drunk or high at the table? Wasn't it maybe my turn to be the embarrassed one? Must remain loyal, I'd think. The morning after a dinner party, her makeup applied but still in her robe, my mother would be sheepish. "Well, it was nice to see Dean again." That would have been the perfect time to sit her down, to say, "Do you remember how out of control you were last night? What can we do to help you?" I'm forever thinking of all our missed opportunities, 6 kids and a husband, and not one of us spoke up. I imagine her at a rehab center in Arizona or California, a state she'd never been to. "Who knew I'd be so good at pottery?" I can hear her saying, and "I'm really looking forward to rebuilding my life." Sobriety would not have stopped the cancer that was quietly growing inside her, but it would have allowed her to hold her head up, to recall what it felt like to live without shame, if only for a few years. "Do you think it was my fault that she drank?" my father asked not long ago. It's the assumption of an amateur, someone who stops after his second vodka tonic and quits taking his pain medication before the prescription runs out. It's almost laughable, this insistence on a reason. I think my mother was lonely without her children, her fan club. But I think she drank because she was an alcoholic. "How can you watch that crap?" he would say whenever he walked into the house on Maui and caught me in front of intervention. "Well, I'm not only watching it," I'd tell him. "I'm also signing my name." This was never enough for him. "You're in Hawaii, sitting indoors in the middle of the day. Get out of here, why don't you? Get some sun." And so I'd put on my shoes and take a walk, never on the beach, but along the road or through residential neighborhoods. I saw a good deal of trash, cans, bottles, fast food wrappers, the same junk I see in England. I saw flattened cane toads with tire treads on them. I saw small birds with brilliant red heads. One afternoon, I pushed an SUV that had stalled in traffic. The driver was perhaps in his mid-20s and was talking on the phone when I offered a hand. He nodded, so I took up my position at the rear and remembered after the first few yards what a complete pain in the ass it is to help someone in need. I thought he'd just steer to the curb, but instead he went another 100 or so feet down the road where he turned the corner. "Does he expect me to push him all the way home?" I asked myself, panting. Eventually, he pulled over and put on the brake. The guy never thanked me or even put down his phone. "Asshole," I thought. Back at the house, I took another stack of papers and started signing my name to them. "That's not your signature," Hugh said, frowning over my shoulder. "It's what's become of my signature," I told him, looking at the scrawl in front of me. You could sort of make out a D and an S, but the rest was like a silhouette of a mountain range or a hospital patient's medical chart just before he's given the bad news. In my defense, it never occurred to me that I'd be signing my name 5,000 times, in the course of my entire life maybe, but not in one shot. This was not the adulthood that I had predicted for myself, an author of books, spending a week in Hawaii with his handsome, longtime boyfriend before deciding which house to return to. I had wished for it, sure, but I'd also wished for a complete head transplant. Hugh had made himself a Manhattan and was sitting on the patio with my manuscript. A minute passed, then two, then five. "Why aren't you laughing?" I called. I was living in New York, still broke and unpublished, when my mother died. Aside from the occasional Sidney Sheldon novel, she wasn't a reader, so she didn't understand the world I was fluttering around the edges of. If she thought it was hopeless or that I was wasting my time writing, she never said as much. My father, on the other hand, was more than happy to predict a dismal future. Perhaps it was despite him that she supported us in our far-fetched endeavors, art school for me and Gretchen, Amy at Second City. Just when we needed money, at the moment before we had to ask for it, checks would arrive. "A little something to see you through," the accompanying notes would read. "Love, your old mother." Was she sober in those moments, I wondered, signing my name to another sheet of paper? Was it with a clear mind that she believed in us, or was it just the booze talking? The times I miss her most are when I see something she might have liked, a piece of jewelry or a painting, the view of a white sand beach off a balcony, palm trees. How I'd have loved to spoil her with beautiful things. On one of her last birthdays, I gave her a wasp's nest that I'd found in the woods. It was all I could afford, a nursery that bugs made and left behind. "I'll get you something better later," I promised. "Of course you will," she said, reaching for her glass. "And whatever it is, I'm sure I'm going to love it." Mm-hmm. the spirit world. Our house on Emerald Isle is divided down the middle and has an E beside one front door and a W beside the other. The east side is ruled by Hugh, and the bedroom we share is on the top floor. It opens onto a deck that overlooks the ocean and is next to Amy's room, which is the same size as ours, but is shaped differently. Unlike Lisa and Paul, who were on the west side of the house and could probably sleep on burlap without noticing it, Amy likes nice sheets. She'd packed a new set in her suitcase, and on the night before Thanksgiving, as I helped her make her bed, she mentioned a friend who'd come to her apartment for dinner the previous evening in New York. "He drinks Coke, right? So I went to the store on the corner to buy some," she said. "And you know how those new bottles have names on the labels, Blake or Kelly or whatever?" I nodded. "Well, there were only two left on the shelf. One with Mom printed on it, and the other with Tiffany." I reached for a pillowcase. "Do you think if I were dead, there would have been three bottles on the shelf instead of two, and the third would have had my name on it?" Amy thought for a moment. "Yes. So the only Cokes at that store in New York City are for people in our family who have died?" She smoothed out the bedspread. "Yes." I couldn't tell if she honestly believed this. It's hard to say with Amy. On the one hand, she's very pragmatic, and on the other, she's open to just about anything. Astrology, for instance. I wouldn't call her a nut exactly, but she has paid good money to have her chart done, and if you're talking about someone, she'll often ask when this person's birthday is, and then say something like, "Ah, a Gemini. Okay, that makes sense now." She's big on acupuncture as well, which I also tend to think is dubious, at least for things like allergies. That said, I admire people who are curious and open their minds to new possibilities, especially after a certain age. You have to draw the line somewhere, though, and with me, it's my anus. When I was in my early 30s, it became a thing to have colonics. A number of my friends started going to a man in Chicago and discussing the rubble he'd discovered in their lower intestines, a pumpkin seed, and I haven't eaten pumpkin in 8 years. Their insides were like Pharaoh's tombs, dark catacombs littered with ancient relics. Now people are giving themselves coffee enemas, believing it wards off and even cures cancer. "I think I'll take the cancer, thank you," my sister Lisa said to me on Thanksgiving morning. "Amen to that," I agreed. Lisa's not open to the things that Paul and Amy are, but she has her equivalents. If you told her, for instance, that she was holding her car keys the wrong way and that there were meetings for people like her, she'd likely attend them for at least 3 months. One of the groups she was going to lately was for mindful eating. "It's not about dieting. We don't believe in that," she said. "You're supposed to carry on as usual, 3 meals a day plus snacks and desserts or whatever. The difference is that now you think about it." She then confessed that the donut she had just finished had been her 6th of the day. "Who brought these?" she asked. I looked at the box and whimpered a little. "Kathy, I think." "God damn her," Lisa whispered. A few weeks before we came to the beach, Amy paid a great deal of money to visit a well-known psychic. The woman has a long waiting list, but someone pulled a few strings, and not long after getting the idea, Amy had her session, which took place over the phone and lasted for an hour. She sent me a brief email after it was over and went into greater detail as we rode with Gretchen from the Raleigh airport to Emerald Isle the day before Thanksgiving. "So start again from the top," I said. "Was it scary?" "It was maybe like calling someone in prison and having one person after another get on the line," she said from the back seat. "First, I talked to Mom for a while, who's doing well, by the way, and takes credit for setting up you and Hugh. Then Tiffany appeared." I ripped open a bag of almonds. "Yeah, right." "Ordinarily, I'd be like that too," Amy said, "but the psychic's voice changed after Mom went away. She sounded tough all of a sudden, and started by saying, 'I really don't feel like talking to you right now. This is a favor, okay?'" Tiffany thanked Amy for cleaning up the mess she'd left after she committed suicide. "That's strange," I said. "I mean, how would the psychic have known anything about that? Amy sat up and moved closer so that her head was between my seat and Gretchen's. I know. She said that Tiffany had tried to kill herself before, also true, and that she always knew she was going to do this, the only question was when. It was crazy how much she got right. Your sister was mentally ill, she said, possibly bipolar, and stopped taking her medication because she didn't want to dull herself. She said Tiffany felt like everyone was taking from her, using her. That was certainly true, I said. Most of what Tiffany had to say was directed at you, Amy told me. She wants you to know that the two of you are okay now and that she's not mad anymore. She's not mad, I said. Her. I'm the one who had reason to be mad. She said she'd misunderstood you and that lately she's been working on herself. You have to work on yourself after you're dead? I asked. It seemed a bit much, like having to continue a diet or your participation in AA. I thought that death let you off the hook when it came to certain things, that it somehow purified you. Tiffany's been hanging out a lot with Mom's dad, Grandpa Leonard, Amy told me. This made me furious for some reason, but she didn't even know him. I guess they met there, Amy said. And where is that? Amy shrugged. I don't know. It's not like you can ask 1,000 questions and get them answered. They tell you what they want to tell you and you just listen. I tried to let that sink in. She and Mom are finally getting along, Amy continued. She mainly wanted to let you know that she has no hard feelings. The psychic said Tiffany's been trying to tell you this herself and asked if you've had a lot of problems with your phone lately. No. Power outages? Again, I said no. What about butterflies? Are you serious? I asked. Our house last winter was loaded with them. I've never seen anything like it. In the summer, fine, but this was crazy. Hugh and I talked about it every day. Amy crossed her arms. It was Tiffany. She was trying to contact you. The appointment with the psychic had unnerved the whole family. Tiffany was calmer than normal, but still it was like an actual conversation with her, Amy said. You remember how those were, right? We'd be shaking while they were going on. Then we'd think about them for weeks afterward. I remember, Gretchen and I said at the same time. After Tiffany signed off, Amy spoke to an actor she'd known who died of a heroin overdose a few years back, and then to her first serious boyfriend, John Chocontes, who had a brain aneurysm when he was 25. Because she'd had a session so recently, I was welcome to cut to the front of the line and have one of my own the following week. Do you want me to give you the psychic's number? I said nothing. Is that a no? Amy asked. Often, when signing books, I will pretend to have powers. Well, look at the Scorpio, I'll say, when someone approaches my table. I'm just guessing. I wouldn't know a Scorpio from a double Sagittarius. The key I learned is to speak with authority. It's never, are you a Libra? But rather, it's about time I had a Libra up in here. Every now and then, I'll be right, and the person will be shocked. How did you know my sign? They'll ask. The same way I know you have a sister. If I'm right about the sister as well, the person I'm talking to will become like a cat released into a new setting, very low to the ground and suspicious. Who are you talking to? Did one of my friends put you up to this? I met a young woman a few years back, and after being right about both her sign and her sister, I said, as if I were trying to recall something I had dreamed, you were in a hospital earlier this week. Not for yourself, but for someone else. You were visiting someone very close to you. The woman fell apart before my eyes. My mother has cancer. They operated, but how do you... What are you doing? I can't help it, I told her. I know things. I see them. I don't, of course. Those were just guesses. Pulled out of my ass in order to get a rise out of someone. Hugh said the psychic Amy went to did the same thing, but I'm not sure. How would she know what Tiffany sounded like? Looked her up on YouTube, he said. read one of your stories, these people tell you what you want to hear. It's their way of getting you to come back. There's something about picking the psychic apart that I don't like. It's cynical and uninteresting. That said, I knew I didn't want to book a session. My mother and I were very close, and though I miss her terribly, I'm not sure I need to talk to her again. Since her death, I thought of it as an impossibility. Now it felt like a decision, like Mom wants to speak to me, and I'm saying no. But what if she's angry at me for some reason? What would I do with that? As for Tiffany, a few months after she died, a Dutch film crew came to Sussex and followed me around for 3 days. Our conversation was all over the place. We talked about England, writing, life with Hugh. The last hour was shot on a hilltop overlooking my house. The interviewer, a man named Vim, sat beside me. Off camera, he'd mentioned that my sister had recently taken her life. Now he brought it up again. What if you could ask her one question? It seemed like such a television moment, the intimacy unearned, grotesque almost. And so I paused and blinked hard. Then I said, I'd ask, can I have back that money I loaned you? What troubled me most about Amy's talk with the psychic was the notion that the dead are unsettled, that they linger. I said to Lisa at the beach that Thanksgiving, if they can see us from wherever they are, what's to stop them from watching us on the toilet? Lisa took a moment to consider this. I'm guessing that certain places are just off limits. And who would make them off limits, I asked. I don't know, she said. God, maybe? I mean, beats me. We were returning from a walk and came upon our father in the middle of the street, a quarter mile from the house. He was dressed in jeans and had a flat-topped cap on his head. His flannel shirt was untucked, and the tail of it drooped from beneath the hem of his windbreaker. What are you doing here? I asked. Looking for someone, he said. Lisa asked who, and he said he didn't know. I was just hoping somebody might come along and invite me to his house to watch the game. The Panthers are playing this afternoon, and you don't have a goddamn TV. You thought someone was just going to say, hey, why don't you come to my place and watch some football? Lisa asked. I was going to build up to it, my father said. You know, drop hints and so forth. The day after Thanksgiving was bright and unseasonably warm. Hugh made ham sandwiches for lunch, and we ate on the deck. We need to have a code word, so when the next one of us dies, we'll know if the psychic is for real, Amy said. She turned to Dad, the most likely candidate for ceasing to live. What'll yours be? He gave it no thought. Ecstasy. Like the drug? I asked. He picked up his sandwich. What drug? It should be something you say a lot, I told him. Something that would let us know it's really you. Maybe you've gained weight. Or Obama's from Kenya. Those are both three words, Lisa noted. What about Broderson, I said, referring to a North Carolina painter whose work my father collected in the 1970s. Oh, that's perfect, Amy said. I went into the kitchen to get another napkin, and by the time I returned, the topic had changed, and Dad was discussing someone who goes to his gym. The guy is in his 40s and apparently stands too close in the locker room. He undresses me with his eyes, and it makes me uncomfortable, my father said. How does someone undress you with his eyes when you're already undressed? I asked. By that point, what's he looking at? Your soul? On our final evening at the beach over the Thanksgiving weekend, Amy and my niece Madeline usually host a spa night. They dress in uniforms and let it be known beforehand that clients are expected to tip, and generously. Facials are given, and Kathy offers foot massages. The treatments feel great, but the best part is listening to Amy, who plays the role of the supervisor. This year, while massaging clay into my father's face, she asked him if he was alone this evening or with his gay lover. I know that a lot of men, such as yourself, also like their testicles waxed, Amy said. If that is of any interest to you, sir, I can get my trainee, Madeline, right on it. Maddie, you up for this? It's so subversive, not just insisting that our father is gay, but that his 12-year-old granddaughter might want to rip the hair off his balls. Before the clay is rubbed into our faces, we're outfitted in shower caps, and afterward, while it dries, we lie back with cucumber slices on our eyes. Paul programs his iPad to play spa music, or what passes for music in such places, the sound of a waterfall, or rustling leaves, a whale saying something nice to another whale, a harp. This year, I lifted the cucumbers off my eyes and saw Lisa and Dad stretched out like corpses, fast asleep. Paul was out as well, and Gretchen, whose legs were shin deep in the warm, whirling bath, was getting there. It seems there was a perfectly good explanation for all the butterflies in our Sussex house the previous winter. From what I'd read since Amy brought it up, they flew in through our windows in early autumn, then passed into a kind of hibernation. Hugh and I were away until right before Christmas, and when we returned and cranked up the heat, the butterflies, mainly tortoise shells, dozens and dozens of them, awoke, wrongly believing that spring had arrived. They were on all the second floor windows, batting against the panes, desperate to get out. As symbols go, they're a bit too sweet. Right for Lisa, but all wrong for Tiffany, who'd have been better represented by something more dynamic. Crows, maybe. Two big ones flew down the chimney of my office that winter and tore the place apart, systematically overturning and then shitting on everything I cared about. What, I wondered, placing the cucumbers back over my eyes, would my symbol be? The last time I saw my sister Tiffany was at the stage door at Symphony Hall in Boston. I'd just finished a show and was getting ready to sign books when I heard her say, "David, David, it's me." We hadn't spoken in 4 years at that point, and I was shocked by her appearance. Tiffany always looked like my mother when she was young. Now she looked like my mother when she was old, though at the time she couldn't have been more than 45. "It's me, Tiffany." She held up a paper bag with the Starbucks logo on it. Her shoes looked like she'd found them in a trash can. "I have something for you." There was a security guard holding the stage door open, and I said to him, "Will you close that, please?" I had filled the house that night. I was in charge, Mr. Sedaris. "The door," I repeated. "I'd like for you to close it now." And so the man did. He shut the door in my sister's face, and I never saw her or spoke to her again. Not when she was evicted from her apartment, not when she was raped, not when she was hospitalized after her first suicide attempt. She was, I told myself, someone else's problem. I couldn't deal with her anymore. "Well," the rest of my family said, "it was Tiffany. Don't be too hard on yourself. We all know how she can be." Perhaps like the psychic, they were just telling me what I needed to hear, something to ease my conscience and make me feel that underneath it all, I'm no different from anyone else. They've always done that for me, my family. It's what keeps me coming back.
Unbuttoned. I was in Paris, waiting to undergo what promised to be a pretty disgusting medical procedure, when I got word that my father was dying. The hospital I was in had opened in 2000, but it seemed newer. From our vantage point on the second floor radiology department, Hugh and I could see the cafes situated side by side in the modern, sun-filled concourse below. "It's like an airline terminal," he observed. "Yeah," I said. "Terminal illness." Under different circumstances, I might have described the place as cheerful. It was the wrong word to use, though, when I just had a CAT scan. And in a few hours' time, a doctor was scheduled to snake a multi-purpose device up the hole in my penis. It was a sort of wire that took pictures, squirted water, and had little teeth. These would take bites out of my bladder, which would then be sent to a lab and biopsied. So cheerful, not so much, at least for me. I'd hoped to stick out in the radiology wing, to be too youthful or hale to fit in. But looking around the waiting area, I saw that everyone was roughly my age and was either bald or had gray hair. If anyone belonged here, it was me. The good news was that the urologist I met with later that afternoon was loaded with personality. This made him the opposite of one I'd seen earlier that month in London when I'd gone in with an unmistakable urinary tract infection. The pain was a giveaway, as was the blood that came out when I peed. UTIs are common in women, but in men are usually a sign of something more serious. The London urologist was sullen and Scottish, the first to snake a multi-purpose wire up my penis, but sadly not the last. The only time he came to life was when the camera started sending images to the monitor he was looking at. "Ah," he trilled, "there's your sphincter." I've always figured there was a reason my insides were on the inside, so I wouldn't have to look at them. Therefore, I said something noncommittal like, "Great," and went back to wishing that I were dead. Because it really hurts to have a wire shoved up that narrow and uninviting slit. The urologist we'd come to see in Paris looked over the results of the scan I'd just undergone and announced that they revealed nothing out of the ordinary. He also studied the results of the tests I'd had in London, including one for my prostate. My eyes had been screwed shut while it took place, but I'm fairly certain it involved forcing a Golden Globe Award up my ass. I didn't cry or hit anyone, though. Thus, it annoyed me to see what the English radiologist who'd performed the test had written in the comment section of his report. Patient tolerated the transrectal probe poorly. "How dare he," I thought. In the end, a quick prostate check and the CAT scan were the worst I had to suffer that day in Paris. After taking everything into consideration, the French doctor, who was young and handsome, like someone who'd play a doctor on TV, decided it wasn't the right time to take little bites out of my bladder. "Better to give it another month," he said, adding that I shouldn't worry too much. Were you younger, your urinary tract infection might not have been an issue, but at your age, it's always best to be on the safe side. That evening, Hugh and I took the train back to London and bought next-day plane tickets for the U.S. My father was by then in the intensive care unit, where doctors were draining great quantities of ale-colored fluid from his lungs. His heart was failing, and he wasn't expected to live much longer. "This could be it," my sister Lisa wrote me in an email. The following morning, as we waited to board our flight, I learned that he'd been taken from intensive care and put in a regular hospital room. By the time we arrived in Raleigh, my father was back at Springmore, the assisted living center he'd been in for the past year. I walked into his room at 5 in the afternoon and was rattled by how thin and frail he was. Asleep, he looked long dead, like something unearthed from a pharaoh's tomb. The head of his bed had been raised, so he was almost in a sitting position, his open mouth a dark, seemingly bottomless hole, and his hands stretched out before him. The television was on, as always, but the sound was turned off. "Are you looking for your sister?" an aide asked. She directed us down the hall where a dozen people in wheelchairs sat watching the Andy Griffith Show. Just beyond them, in a grim, fluorescent-lit room, Lisa and my sister-in-law Kathy were talking to a hospice nurse they had recently engaged. "What's Mr. Sedaris's age?" the young woman asked as Hugh and I took seats. "He'll be 96 in a few weeks," Kathy said. "Height?" Lisa looked through her papers. 5'6". "Really?" I thought. My father was never super tall, but I'd assumed he was at least 5'9". Had he honestly shrunk that much? "Weight?" More shuffling of papers. 120, Lisa answered. "Well, now he's just showing off," I said. The hospice nurse needed to record my father's blood pressure, so we went back to his room where Kathy gently shook him awake. "Dad, were you napping?" When he came to, my father focused on Hugh. The tubes that had been put down his throat in the hospital had left him hoarse. Speaking was a challenge. Thus his, "Hey!" was hard to make out. "We just arrived from England," Hugh said. My father responded enthusiastically, and I wondered why I couldn't go over and kiss him, or at least say hello. Unless you count his hitting me, we were never terribly physical with each other, and I wasn't sure I could begin at this late date. "I figured you'd rally as soon as I spent a fortune on last-minute tickets," I said, knowing that if the situation reversed, he'd have stayed put, at least until a discount could be worked out. All he's ever cared about is money, so it had hurt me to learn a few years earlier that he'd cut me out of his will. Had he talked it over with me, had he said, for example, that I seemed comfortable enough, it might have been different. But I heard about it secondhand. He'd wanted me to find out after he died. It would be like a scene in a movie, the wealthy man's children crowded into the lawyer's office, and to my son David, I leave nothing. When I confronted him about the will, he said he'd consider leaving me a modest sum, but only if I promised that Hugh would touch none of the money. Of course, I said no. "Actually, don't worry," I said of the plane tickets. "I'll just pay for them with part of my inheritance. Oops."
"Ah, come on now," he moaned. His voice was weak and soft, no louder than rustling leaves.
"I'm going to turn him over and examine his backside for bed sores," the hospice nurse said. "So if any of y'all need to turn away." I was in the far corner of the room, beneath a painting my father had made in the late 60s of a monk with a mustache. Beside me was the guitar I was given in the 5th grade. "What's this doing here?" I asked. "Dad had it restrung a few months ago and said he was going to learn how to play," Lisa told me. She pointed to a keyboard wedged behind a plaster statue of a joyful girl with her arms spread wide. "The piano, too." "Now?" I asked. "He's had all this time, but decided to wait until he was connected to tubes?" After the hospice nurse had finished, my father's dinner was brought in, all of it pureed like baby food. Even his water was mixed with a thickener that gave it the consistency of nectar. He has a bone that protrudes from the back of his neck and causes food to go down the wrong way, Lisa explained, so he can't have anything solid or liquid. As Kathy spooned the mush into my father's mouth, Hugh picked the can of thickener off the dinner tray, read the ingredients, and announced that it was just cornstarch. "So how was your flight?" Lisa asked us. "Time crawled." Amber-colored urine slowly collected in the bag attached to my father's catheter. The room was sweltering. "Was that dinner okay, Dad?" Lisa asked. He raised a thumb.
"Excellent!"
How had she and Paul and Kathy managed to do this day after day? Conversation was pretty much out of the question, so they mainly offered observations in louder-than-normal voices,
she was nice, or it looks like it might start raining again.
I was relieved when my father got drowsy and we could all leave and go to dinner.
Do you want me to turn your TV to Fox News? Lisa asked as we put our coats on.
Fox News,
my father mumbled. Lisa picked up the remote, but when she jabbed it in the direction of the television, nothing happened.
I can't figure out which channel that is, so why don't you watch CSI Miami instead?
Amy arrived from New York at 10 the following morning, wearing a black and white polka dot coat she'd bought on our last trip to Tokyo. Instead of taking her straight to Springmore, Hugh and I drove her to my father's place, where we met up with Lisa and Gretchen. Our dad started hoarding in the late 80s. A broken ceiling fan here, an expired can of peaches there, until eventually the stuff overtook him and spread into the yard. I hadn't been inside the house since before he was moved to Springmore, and though Lisa had worked hard at clearing it of junk, the overall effect was still jaw-dropping. His car, for instance, looked like the one in Silence of the Lambs that the decapitated head was found in. You'd think it had been made by spiders out of dust and old pollen. It was right outside the front door and acted as an introduction to the horrors that awaited us.
Whose turd is this on the floor next to the fireplace? I called out a few minutes after descending the filthy carpeted stairs into the basement.
Amy looked over my shoulder at it, as did Hugh, and finally Lisa, who said, "It could be my dog's from a few months ago." I leaned a bit closer. "Or it could be..." Before I could finish, Hugh scooped it up with his bare hands and tossed it outside.
"You people, my God."
Then he went upstairs to help Gretchen make lunch. Continuing through the house, I kept asking the same question. Why would anyone choose to live this way? It wasn't just the falling down ceilings or the ragged spider webs draped like bunting over the doorways. It wasn't the tools and appliances he'd found on various curbs, the vacuum cleaners with frayed cords, or the shorted out hair dryers he'd promised himself he would fix, but the sense of hopelessness they conveyed when heaped into rooms that used to seem so normal, no different in size or design from those of our neighbors, but were now ruined. "Whoever buys this house will just have to throw a match on it and start over," Gretchen said. What struck me most were my father's clothes. Hugh gets after me for having too many, but I've got nothing compared with my dad, who must own 25 suits and twice as many sport coats. Dozens of them were from Brooks Brothers, when there was just the one store in New York and the name meant something. Others were from long-gone college shops in Ithaca and Syracuse, the sort that sold smart jackets and white bucks. There were sweaters in every shade, the cardigans on hangers, their sleeves folded in a self-embrace to prevent them from stretching, the V-necks and turtlenecks folded in stacks, a few unprotected but mostly moth-proofed in plastic bags. There were polo shirts and dress shirts and casual shirts from every decade of post-war America. Some hung like rags, buttons missing, great tears in the backs, as if he'd worn them while running too slowly from bears. Others were still in their wrapping, likely bought 2 or 3 years ago. I could remember him wearing most of the older stuff, to the club, to work, to the parties he'd attend, always so handsome and stylish. Though my mother's clothes had been disposed of, all those shoulder pads moldering in some landfill, my father's filled 7 large closets, one of them a walk-in, and hung off the shower curtain rods in all 3 bathrooms. They were crammed into dressers and piled on shelves, hats and coats and scarves and gloves, neckties and bow ties, too many to count, all owned by the man who since his retirement seemed to wear nothing but the same jeans and the same T-shirt with holes in it he'd worn the day before and the day before that, the man who'd always found an excuse to skimp on others but allowed himself only the best. There were clothes from his self-described fat period, from the time he slimmed down, and from the years since my mother died when he's been out and out skinny, none of them thrown away or donated to Goodwill, and all of them now reeking of mildew. I nicked a vibrant red button-down shirt from the 50s, noticing later that it had a sizable hole in the back. Then I claimed the camel-colored, moth-eaten beret I'd bought him on a school trip to Madrid in 1975. "It suits you," Hugh observed. "It matches your skin and makes you look bald," Amy said. We were all in the dining room, going through boxes with more boxes in them, when I glanced over at the window and saw a doe step out of the woods and approach some of the trash on the lawn near the carport, head lowered, as if she'd followed the scent of 50-year-old house paint hardened and rusted through cans. "Look," we whispered, afraid our voices from inside the house might frighten her off. "Isn't she beautiful?" We couldn't remember there being deer in the woods when we were young. Perhaps our dogs had scared them off. "Oh," Lisa said, her voice as soft as our father's. "I hope she doesn't step on a rusty nail." Gretchen served Greek food for lunch, and afterward we drove to Springmore. It was a Saturday afternoon in late February, cold and rainy. Our father was in his reclining chair covered with a blanket when we arrived, not asleep, but not exactly awake either. It was this new state he occasionally drifted into, neither here nor there. After killing the overhead lights, we seated ourselves around his room and continued the conversation we'd been having in the car. "I asked Marshall to write Dad's obituary, but he doesn't feel up to it," Gretchen said, referring to her boyfriend of nearly 30 years. The rest of us glanced over at our father. "He can't hear us," Gretchen said. She looked at me. "So will you write it?" I've been writing about my father for ages, but when it comes to the details of his life, the year he graduated from college, etc., I'm worthless. Even his job remains a mystery to me. He was an engineer, and I like to joke that up until my late teens, I thought that he drove a train. "I really don't know all that much about him," I said, scooting my chair closer to his recliner. He looked 20 years older than he had on my last visit to Raleigh, 6 months earlier. One change was his nose. The skin covering it was stretched tight, revealing facets I'd never before noticed. His eyes were shaped differently, like the diamonds you'd find on playing cards, and his mouth looked empty, though it was in fact filled with his own teeth. He did this thing now, opening wide and stretching out his lips, as if pantomiming a scream. I kept thinking it was in preparation for speech, but then he'd say nothing. I was trying to push the obituary off on Lisa when we heard him call out for water. Hugh got a cup, filled it from the tap in the bathroom, and stirred in some cornstarch to thicken it. My father's oxygen tube had fallen out of his nose, so we summoned a nurse who showed us how to reattach it. When she left, he half raised his hand, which was purpled with spots and resembled a claw.
"What's on your mind?"
he asked Amy, who had always been his favorite, and was seated a few yards away. His voice couldn't carry for more than a foot or two, so Hugh repeated the question. "What's on your mind?" "You?" Amy answered. "I'm just thinking of you, wanting you to feel better." My father looked up at the ceiling, and then at us.
"Am I real to you kids?"
I had to lean in close to hear him, especially the last half of his sentences. After 3 seconds, he'd run out of steam and the rest was just breath. Plus, the oxygen machine was loud. "Are you what?"
"Real."
He gestured to his worn-out body and the bag on the floor half filled with his urine.
"I'm in this new life now."
"It'll just take some getting used to," Hugh said. My father made a sour face.
I'm a zombie.
I don't know why I insisted on contradicting him. Not really, I said. Zombies can walk and eat solid food. You're actually more like a vegetable.